Hal Brignola stepped into the Stony Man computer lab, hoping for good news.
They've secured the airfield, Hal. From the sounds of it, though, it wasn't pretty.
Any casualties, Carmen?
Mostly on their end, but we lost a couple Rangers, along with the point man for that FBI team Mac was working with.
That's unfortunate.
We've got people monitoring the control tower along with their radio facilities. They've been in touch with the cargo plane and put them in a holding pattern while they clean things up.
Looks like wait and see, then.
At least for now. I'll keep you posted if there are any changes.
Do that.
Hey, Brognola. I know this is a sidebar, but a DEA team just shut down that harbor warehouse the Koreans were using in San Pedro. Between that and knocking off the killboys in Koreatown, I think we've pretty much slammed the door on their West Coast smuggling operations.
Brognola walked across the room toward Kissinger's station.
At least for now. You can bet they'll work some other angle first chance they get.
Hey, you're probably right.
Whoa, Daddy!
He either finally drank one too many cups of coffee, Hal, or he's found something.
Well, with Bear, there's no such thing as too much coffee.
The two men made their way over to Kurtzman's station.
You found something?
More like a hat trick. Check this out.
What's that on your screen?
That, my friend, is the north flank of the Chanchong Mountain Range. It's about 10 miles north of the DMZ.
Okay, I know the area. Looks pretty benign to me.
From a distance, yeah. According to all our intel, the only thing going there is an old mining site. And word was they'd pretty much played out all the veins inside the mountain. But let's move in for a closer look.
Barracks. Barbed wire perimeter fences.
Concentration camp?
I think they call them something else, but yeah, that'd be my guess. There's another angle shot that shows a few dozen people working a field about a quarter mile north of here. Poppies, from the look of it.
Let's have a look.
Nah, just take my word for it. I want to get to the good stuff.
There's more?
You see that service road that leads right up to the mountains? It's dirt, so I was able to get a good read on the tire tracks leading there. Now, here's a better look. The left set of tracks are from the SATCAM. They're deep enough that you can see they're made by a multi-axle vehicle with four tires to an axle. I ran with a hunch and did a cross-check on the missile transporters they'd most likely be using. And bingo.
And by missile launchers, I presume we're talking nukes.
Now you're darn tootin'. We might want to get NSA to redirect a couple satellites over the area for some infrareds, but even now I'd bet my paycheck we've just found the needle in the haystack.
Yim glared at An Chung-hee. He was still concerned about the Ministry of Internal Intelligence's investigation, but the cook's news brought further frustration.
This can't be happening! A prison revolt!
Yim grabbed for the first thing in reach, a crystal ashtray lying on top of his desk in the den of his bungalow quarters at the concentration camp. When Yim cocked his arm, the cook flinched, fearing that he was about to pay the price for being the bringer of bad news. Yim turned away from the ruined television and walked to his wet bar.
Give me the details. All of them.
I don't have any specifics, at least not in terms of how they plan to carry it out. I only know that it's supposed to happen tomorrow morning. I was supposed to put something in the food given to the security detail, enough to knock them out, or at least make them drowsy.
You're in on it?
I only pretended to be. I played along, hoping I could get more details before I came to you.
And how long has this been going on? How long have they been plotting this?
Again, I don't have that information. They came to me earlier in the week. I stalled, pretending that I wanted more money than what they were offering, hoping that somewhere along the line they would trip up and give me more details. But beyond drugging the guards, they've kept the plans to themselves.
Who's behind it all? No, wait, let me guess. Kwak Il-su, is he the one?
I would say he's the mastermind. At least he's the one I've been dealing with. I can't say for sure who else is involved. But I've seen him hanging around with No Jae Bong and a few others during rations.
Why tomorrow? Why have they decided to try this tomorrow?
I'm afraid that's my fault. Kwak came to me this morning and said they'd come up with a way to meet my price, or at least most of it. I was concerned that if I tried to stall any longer, they would take me out of the loop and try another way. So I agreed, and that's when they said they want to do it tomorrow.
How did they propose to pay you? None of them has any money on them, and most of them were stripped of all their possessions before they were sent here. Have they been siphoning opium from the fields?
Not that I know of. They claimed to have some kind of currency on them and said they'd be good for more once they were free.
In their dreams.
I didn't really believe them, but as I said, I kept bartering in hopes I'd get more information. As for them finally meeting my price, it has to do with one of the new prisoners, the businessman from the South.
Lim?
I think that's his name. He promised to put up the money I asked for once he was back across the DMZ.
Yim glanced past the intern at the door to his bedroom. He'd had Lim's daughter, Na Li, brought to the bungalow after morning rations, figuring to repeat the ravishing he'd enjoyed with her the day before. He'd been interrupted before he could indulge himself, however, first by the call from Major Jin regarding the undercover agent from MII, then by this unexpected bombshell from An. Now, in light of everything that was happening, the last thing on Yim's mind was sexual gratification. If anything, he was of a mind to haul Lim's daughter to the mines and have her killed in front of her father as a way of punishing his treachery. But even that would have to wait. The MII agent was on his way over, and Yim could deal with only one crisis at a time.
If Lim thinks he'll ever see the other side of the DMZ after this, he's very much mistaken.
Na Li sat at the foot of Yim's bed. Lying on the bed beside her was a set of red silk thong underwear and a matching bra and camisole. Yim had told her to change into the garments an hour ago, but she couldn't bring herself to do it. The thought of putting it on and being forced to parade around for the Commandant's amusement repulsed her almost as much as the thought of what he would do to her after he'd finished his ogling. She tried her best to take solace in the fact that the abuse would not go on beyond today. She would kiss the ground once she was back on South Korean soil, she promised herself, and never again would she take her freedom for granted. The Commandant stood in the doorway and stared at her.
You didn't change as I asked you.
I'm sorry. I was just about to.
No matter. It's just as well, because there's been a change in plans. The guards will take you back and you can spend the rest of the day in the fields with your mother.
I can go?
Yes, now come along. I have business to attend to.
Na Li stood, her knees trembling. She feared that Yim was toying with her and that as soon as she came within his reach, he would grab her. But he stood back and waved to her impatiently.
Don't try my patience!
The young woman nodded and walked past him into the main room of the bungalow. An had already left. In his place, the guard was waiting for her.
Take her to the puppy fields. But Na Li, I'll want to see you again later. I have a special surprise in store for you.
Na Li turned and followed the guard out of the bungalow. There was another man standing at the bottom of the steps, clearly waiting to speak with Yim. The man leered at the woman and pursed his lips.
You're the one I would have chosen.
Na Li lowered her eyes, avoiding the undercover agent's gaze as she walked past him. Fresh tears welled in Nali's eyes, but she forced them back. As the guard escorted her down the walkway leading back to the prison yard, she tried to clear her mind of everything but the idea that soon she and her family would be free. It was a futile exercise, however, because as soon as she reached the prison yard, she was distracted by the sight of Ratir. Her boyfriend had stopped his hammering at the rock pile and was watching her. Ratir was expressionless at first, but when a nearby prisoner pointed at Na Li, several prisoners began snickering among themselves, and suddenly the teenager snapped.
Take it back!
Na Li cringed as she watched the other prisoners rush over to pull her boyfriend off the other man. She knew that some obscene remark about her visit to the bungalow had likely caused the outburst, and when several guards strode toward the rock pile with their rifles raised, Na Li froze with horror, afraid that Ratir's attempt to defend her honor was going to cost him his life.
Get back to work!
Na Li smiled back at her boyfriend, tears streaming down her cheeks. The guard beside her prodded her gently. Wearily, she turned away from her boyfriend and strode past the barracks to the work area where mechanics were just finishing the repairs on the jeep that would take General Oh back to Kaesong. The general was standing next to the vehicle, staring across the prison yard at Yim's bungalow, where Tsai was still awaiting his audience with the commandant.
Sir, we need to take this woman to a field. May we have a ride?
If you must.
Oh took a handkerchief from his pocket and handed it to Na Li. The young woman was startled by the gesture, but before she could respond, Oh had turned from her and was fumbling with his cell phone. The jeep accelerated past the camp. Na Li dabbed the tears from her eyes, taking consolation that soon, at least, she would be working alongside her mother. She would tell her that she hadn't been molested, but there seemed no point in worrying her with Yim's remark about having a surprise in store for her. Hopefully, whatever business that had diverted the Commandant's attention would continue to take up his time, and she would be left alone for the duration of their captivity. The aircraft carrying Shin Kam Song and Li Ru Kobe to Zane Island had been retrofitted with a 10-seat passenger cabin located between the cockpit and the plane's massive cargo hold. The two scientists were seated in the rear of the cabin along with Shin's wife. The woman was sound asleep, her head resting on her husband's shoulder. Shin himself had managed to doze off briefly, only to be awakened by a sudden jostling within the cabin. He stirred slightly, then closed his eyes again, but when the plane suddenly began to lose altitude, he snapped to with a start.
Don't worry, Shin. I heard them say we're getting ready to land. We probably just ran into some turbulence.
One of the guards whirled in his seat.
No talking!
Leave us alone! You have us where you want us, so quit your bullying!
The guard rose from his seat, brandishing his carbine.
Go ahead! Shoot us! Then try to explain to your superiors why you failed to bring us back alive!
They were talking, sir, so I shot them.
So you don't think I'll shoot you?
Hong Sung Nam bolted from his seat at the front end of the cabin and grabbed the man's rifle.
Enough!
What happened now?
I was just telling our host that if they want our cooperation, they're going to have to start treating us with a little more respect.
We haven't gagged you. We untied you and let you sit together. What more do you want?
Perhaps a little more privacy. Perhaps being allowed to have a little conversation without being beaten or having guns rammed in our faces.
Yes. Is that asking too much? Or are you really afraid two old men and a woman are going to be able to hatch a plot to get the upper hand on you?
Fine. Talk all you want. Any more taunting, however, and we'll just tranquilize the three of you for the rest of the trip.
Fair enough.
Let them be, Song.
Hong turned his back on the prisoners, returning to the front row of the cabin, just as Suk Ban Ho was emerging from the cockpit, where he'd been conferring with crew personnel on the ground at Zane Island.
They finally cleared us for landing. We'll refuel, then continue on to Kaesong.
That's the best news I've heard all day. The sooner we turn these prisoners over, the better.
The one thing I don't understand is why KPA is so eager to have these people returned alive in the first place. Do they really think that there's a way they'll be able to get them to cooperate? And if they betrayed us once, who's to say they won't turn around and do it again?
That's not our concern. If we bring them back alive, there will be promotions and commendations. That's all I'm interested in. If it turns out afterward they were returned in vain, the fault will lie with the poor idiots who take them off our hands. Let them worry about it.
Suk nodded and peered out one of the windows. Staring, he saw the vast, gleaming waters of the Pacific Ocean, as well as the palm-shrouded terrain of Zane Island. They were close enough now that they could also make out the airfield where they would be landing. Cook ran out of the control room to Bolin and Bond, who were standing in the hangar.
I don't think our boys are going to come out of that plane. The pilot said they were in a hurry to move out. Looks like we're going to have to go in after them.
That's going to be risky.
We have no choice.
Then it's so.
That makes it unanimous, then.
The trio waited in the main hangar. The bodies of those slain in the brief skirmish had been dragged into one corner and covered with blankets. The surrounding grounds had been hosed down to remove the blood that had been spilled. Part of the army crew had been dispatched to the control tower and other hangars to ensure that it would appear that it was business as usual at the airfield. The remaining soldiers were assembled in the FETC hangar, ready to carry out whichever of three possible battle plans Cook might decide to employ.
All right, everyone! Hop to it! They're staying inside the bird, so we're gonna have to go with Plan B!
The refueling and mechanical crews were made up of the U.S. Army officers who'd best been able to fit into available FETC uniforms. The remaining officers remained poised just inside the nearby hangar, ready to provide backup. Cook had taken the wheel of the cargo tram, and both Mac Bolin and Jane Bond were concealed inside the first of the tram's freight cars, crouched behind the same crates that had provided cover for the snipers who'd slain FBI agent Ed Scanlon. Bolin's Desert Eagle was tucked inside his web holster. For this mission, like Bond, he'd opted for a sound-suppressed 9mm Colt pistol.
No need to rush. The longer we hold off, the better our chances of getting in without tipping off the others.
Yeah, I know the drill, Bolin.
The plane's open tailgate doubled as a loading ramp and was more than sturdy enough to support the tram.
We're gonna bring the cargo directly into the hold.
As it was standard loading and unloading procedure, the man responded with a nod before moving to one side. Once he had a view of the cavernous hold, he looked around and was relieved to see no other crew members. Crook stepped out of the tram, figuring he could easily overpower the crewman on his own. Another one of the REDI goons that had been guarding the defectors strode into view. He had his carbine with him, but was preoccupied with fishing through his shirt pocket for cigarettes. Crook shot a quick glance over his shoulder. From behind the crates inside the tram, Bolin nodded and pointed to himself, then gestured for Crook to go ahead and take care of the other crewman, who was in the process of loosening the tethers to a freight dolly strapped to the wall of the cargo hold. Crook nodded a greeting to the REDI goon, then moved to the wall and leaned over to unfasten the bind securing a second dolly. He used only one hand, leaving the other free to slip a combat knife from inside his right boot. Out of the corner of his eye, he kept an eye on both the crewman and the REDI agent. Bolin poked his pistol from the tram's covers as the guard brought the cigarette to his lips. The guard was reeling forward when Crook suddenly whirled away from the dollies and lunged into the crewman next to him, knife in hand. Together, the three of them sidestepped the slain REDI guard and approached the doorway leading to the passenger cabin.
Let's finish this.
Hong smoked a cigarette and stared through the window portal of the passenger cabin at the refueling crew and maintenance workers milling around the plane. There seemed to be more men than necessary for the task, but he didn't dwell on the matter. His mind was elsewhere. He was already planning how best to capitalize on the success of his mission. He knew that in the wake of the purges following the Operation Guillotine affair, there were ample opportunities for upward mobility within the ranks. In particular, there were openings within a coveted upper echelon of REDI, which was comprised of solo agents, and given Hong's distaste for what seemed to be an ever-deteriorating caliber of subordinates, he felt it would be worth lobbying for the right to work alone. And though he'd never been keen on the idea of an office position, if the right offer presented itself, he might even consider leaving the field.
Excuse me, pilot, but I thought we were staying put.
We are, but they're bringing our meal provisions. I don't know about you, but I'm starving.
Hong put out his cigarette and joined Sook in staring out at the mobile staircase that was being wheeled into position in front of the open doorway. Two men wearing bright-colored safety vests were standing on the staircase landing, flanking either side of a metal tray stacked with foam containers. Something about the whole arrangement struck Hong as odd, and coming on the heels of seeing the overstaffed ground crew, he felt a sudden apprehension.
Why does it take two men to push a food cart?
Before Sook or the pilot could respond, a slight wind picked up out on the runway, and Hong saw one of the caterer's vests flap open in the breeze, revealing a shoulder holster.
It's a trap!
Sook was instantly on his guard as well, and just as one of the army officers masquerading as a caterer prepared to fling a stun grenade, the REDI operative grabbed hold of the startled pilot and shoved him out through the opening in order to deflect the grenade.
So much for dinner!
Amid all the commotion, Li Ru Ko and the other prisoners ducked low in their passenger seats. The three captives cowered as their guard rushed past them, hoping to escape through the rear door leading to the cargo hold. Bolin rolled off the guard's body and took cover behind the second row of passenger seats. Bon had charged into the fray right behind him. Hong and Sook both aimed for her from the front of the cabin.
Oh, shit! Just my luck!
Crook remained in the cargo hold for a moment, using the doorframe for cover. Once the shots ended, he crouched low and came through the doorway. Hong, suddenly the lone survivor, dived to the floor. He knew his position was hopeless, but he had no intention of surrendering. All that was left for him was the vague consolation that before dying he might at least thwart the enemy's rescue of the hostages. Face to the floorboards, he peered beneath the seats, hoping to empty his magazine into the three captives hiding in the rear of the plane. Lying on the floor between Hong and the captives, however, was Max Bolin.
Checkmate.
Before he met with the undercover agent from the Ministry of Intelligence, there was one matter Yim wanted to attend to. He still had the phone number Lim Seung-hwan had used to make the initial ransom call following their meeting the night before. As he waited for an answer, he stared at the guards who were in the process of dismantling the television he ruined earlier.
Once you're finished, I need a word with you.
Hello, you've reached Lim Seung-hwan's office. How may I help you?
There's been a change in plans to have Lim released tomorrow morning. You see, he's suspected of spying and will be held a bit longer while he undergoes some thorough interrogation.
What do you mean?
Guards, I need you to bring Sergeant Sai into my office. But listen closely. When I put out my cigarette, I want you to aim that gun at his face and search him. He can't be trusted. Do you understand?
Yes, sir!
Yes, sir!
As he waited, Yim lit a cigarette and forced himself to calm down.
It's under control. Everything is under control. Ah, Sergeant Tsai, greetings. Major Jin tells me you're looking for a little recreation.
Yes, I think I just had a look at the woman I'd like to recreate with.
She's a nice one, all right. I think we can arrange something.
I was hoping you'd say that.
First, however, we need to clarify a few things.
Yim stubbed out his cigarette in the same ashtray he'd earlier hurled at the television screen, and one of the guards suddenly stepped forward, raising his carbine to Tsai's face.
What's the meaning of this? Put that case down.
Put your hands in the air. I'll say it one last time. Put your hands in the air, or he'll put a bullet in your skull.
Okay, okay. But those are just engineering tools.
Of course they are. And you're just an engineer, is that it?
I'm with the Corps of Engineers. I was sent here to inspect the bunker.
Save your breath. We know who you are, and we know the real reason for your visit. Ah, Major Jin.
I believe you left a couple of bugs in my office, Sergeant.
And look here. He had a couple of them for me, too.
All right. I also work for the Ministry of Intelligence. I was under orders.
Tell us something we don't already know.
In exchange for what?
Here, have a seat. What makes you think you're in any position to negotiate?
I can tell you what we know. I could turn double agent for you.
Jin released Tsai's arm and exchanged a glance with Yim. The commandant, in turn, took the carbine from the guard.
Guards, you may leave now.
Yes, sir!
One step at a time. First, give us a reason to think you're valuable enough to keep alive. Then we can take it from there.
Okay. Well, we know of efforts to deal with the revival of Operation Guillotine. We also know about General Qin taking over Lim Sungwan's yacht after the kidnapping in the Yellow Sea. We know all about your supposedly clandestine plot, and we've put together an estimate on your strategy should you pull off the coup.
Go on.
First, I want to know if we're going to make some kind of deal.
We still hold all the cards here. Now go on.
You're going to follow the Gaddafi model. Once you take over, you'll wave the olive branch and say that North Korea's days as a rogue nation are over. You'll tell the West that you want us to end our isolation and join the world community. You'll say you'll turn over all your missiles too, but my guess is that the count won't be accurate.
Meaning what?
I think the existence of the missiles and warheads kept here will be kept secret because of the price that they can earn on the black market. We know that you and a few others in the conspiracy have been regularly dealing with parties in the Middle East. I'd say that will go on regardless of how peace-loving you try to sell yourselves to the West. And even if the U.S. and its allies are suspicious, you probably figure they'll be willing to look the other way as long as it looks like you're making good on your overtures.
Jin and Yim weighed the implications of Tsai's disclosure. It was clear to both men that Operation Guillotine was every bit as doomed to failure as its first incarnation earlier in the year. And, like it or not, killing Tsai wasn't going to change matters. The only matter to be determined was how tightly the noose had been drawn around their own necks.
How firmly have we been implicated with the plot?
You're both under suspicion. But if, say, I were to return to Kaesong saying that you'd checked out clean, it might wash with them?
The strongest evidence linking me to the conspiracy is the fact that the kidnapping victims were brought here for detainment. The appearance must be that I was in collusion with General Qin and helped with the kidnapping to raise money for the coup. I need a way to throw off suspicion.
It's simple. Just forego the ransom.
I already postponed exchanging the prisoners for the ransom. I said it was because we suspected Lim might be a spy. But what if it were to come out that the real reason was that I suspected General Qin's motives for the kidnapping? I could make it look as if I wound up helping you make your case against him.
One problem with that. You've already told me that you yourself negotiated the ransom terms with Lim. He'll refute your story.
Not if he's dead. Give me a few moments and I'll figure out a pretext for killing him and his family so they can't talk.
Lim is not the only one who needs to be silenced. I spoke with General Orr when I first arrived, and unfortunately, I briefed him too much on what I was up to. Now he's in a position to shoot holes through whatever story I might try to tell my superiors.
Jin, is Orr still here?
He was just leaving as I was on the way over. He's already on his way back to Kaesong.
I could probably overtake him on my motorcycle.
Nice try, but I don't think we can trust you that much yet. Why don't you just give me the keys?
After Sai handed over the keys, Jin suddenly grabbed a whiskey bottle resting atop the Commandant's wet bar and turned on Sai, swinging it like a club. Yim looked down at Sai's limp form.
Was that really necessary?
I owed him a little something for trying to bug my office. Besides, with a black eye and a broken nose, he'll have more credibility when we use him to clear up this mess.
Since his return from the joint security area, Akira Takedo had resumed his original assignment of helping the Army's CRCC radio crew try to descramble the military frequency used by the KPA. He welcomed the challenge, not only because it called upon his expertise, but also because it demanded his full attention and kept him from watching the clock and chafing his nerves, counting down the time left before his kidnapped cousin's family would be released. Thanks largely to Takedo's incessant tweaking of the directional controls operating the base's satellite dish receptors, a communique being sent out from the North Korean capital of Pyongyang had just been intercepted. Takedo was as stunned as everyone else by the contents of the message.
A coup? All this time we thought they had their hands full playing shell games with their nuke arsenal, and it turns out they're in the middle of trying to put down a coup?
Sure looks that way. From the sound of it, though, I think the whole coup thing more preemptive than prescriptive. They're trying to nip it in the bud.
Yeah, I got that. And you had to figure there's been some amount of rumbling in the ranks. But still, the idea that somebody on the inside is gunning for Kim Jong-il puts a whole new light on things.
Amen. And if they start fighting over who gets to put their finger on a button for those nukes, look out.
Maybe we ought to run with that.
What do you mean?
We could try ghosting a response on this same frequency. Word it the right way, and maybe we can get them to confirm whether they've got their nukes stashed in Changchun. It'd beat waiting for NSA to redirect their SATCOMs back over the mountains.
Not a bad idea. Let's give it a shot.
Takedo stretched, then started across the room. Before he could collar the radio team's North Korean translator, however, he was distracted.
Shit! What is it, Michaels?
Those freaking bastards! You don't want to know.
My cousin?
They just called off the exchange. They're saying now they think he might be a spy.
What a crock. What makes him say that?
Beats me. And they cut off without setting up another time for doing the switch.
Were we able to trace the call?
It was scrambled, but we know it was a cell phone. Same relay tower as the first call, but that's all we got to go on, and they've got at least a dozen different military installations within range of it.
Wait a minute. That tower's atop Changchun Peak, right?
Yeah, so what?
Then it should be able to act as a server connect for callers on both sides of the mountain range. The ones we were looking at before were all on the south flank, facing the DMZ. At the time, we didn't know about this mining camp my people stumbled on.
What? You think they're holding your cousin in the same place where they're hiding their nukes?
It'd make sense, don't you think? I mean, it's secure, it's out of the way as well.
And it's within range of that relay tower. Yeah, here's Changchun. Maybe you're onto something here. But the question is, what do we do about it?
Simple. You're already planning to deploy an ops squad across the DMZ, right? Instead of dropping them on the coast, just do a deeper insertion.
Well, going deep's a bit trickier.
I know that, but it can be done, right? I say we quit playing guessing games and try to get to the bottom of things. Let's hit this base and find out what the hell's going on.
Okay, buddy. We'll go with your gut on this one. I'll have that ops force ready to ship out at nightfall. I know it'll mean waiting, but the darker it is when we come in, the better our chances.
Great. One more thing, though.
What's that?
I'm going along.
General Oh Chol was filled with misgivings as he headed back to Kaesong. His inspection tour of the Changchun facility had started out well enough, but any sense of optimism and well-being had been eroded during the last hour of his stay. And it was a toss-up as to which encounter had unnerved him most, his clash with Major Jin, the revelations of Sergeant Tsai, or the abject sniveling of the teenage girl who had ridden with him in the jeep as far as the poppy fields. Whatever the case, his mood had darkened, and as the jeep he was riding in made its way along the same dirt road that had brought him to Changchun the day before, his back once again began to act up on him.
What a mess.
What's that, sir?
Nothing. Keep driving. And try to steer clear of those ruts.
Yes, sir.
He'd already called his nephew once before leaving the rehabilitation site, but Park Yo-Wee had been busy. The general wanted to apologize for the way he dismissed Park's suspicions. The driver checked the mirrors as Oh glanced over his shoulder.
I think it's the engineer who just rode up from Kaesong.
I think you're right. Pull over and let him catch up.
Hello?
Park, it's your uncle. I want a word with you, but can you hang on for a couple of seconds?
I'll call, Park.
Oak tossed his cell phone aside and began to scramble out of the jeep. But Kwang, one of Jin's subordinates, casually shifted his Ruger back to Oh. The killer strode over to the jeep to make sure both Oh and his driver were dead.
Uncle, what's happened?
Kwang slipped the cell phone into his pocket. Once back at Changchun, he would turn the phone in to Major Jin so that he could check the number Oh had called and have it cross-referenced to determine who the general had been talking to when he'd been shot. Kwang suspected that once the caller was identified, he would have to be tracked down and taken care of as well.
Major Cook, I just got off the phone with Takedo and his contact in the States. It seems this isn't over yet.
What do you mean?
Well, they had plans to fly a special ops force into North Korea to seek out Lim Seong-hwan and the other prisoners after the exchange was called off. But I told them we had a better plan than to take on the unnecessary risks of attempting a deep insertion in a U.S. plane that could be picked up by any KPA radar.
And what's the plan, Mac?
Simple. We assemble a crew here on the island, and we use the North Koreans' own cargo plane to infiltrate their airspace. The only challenge will be deviating from their assigned flight path so that the commandos could be airdropped closer to the Changchun enclave. Of course, once the drop is made, the plane will double back to Incheon, hopefully before the KPA realizes that their defectors aren't being brought back home after all. Oh, and by the way, we find Lim, we find the nukes.
Bolin and Cook reached the airfield, and both men saw Lee Ru Kobe, Shin Kam Song, and Shin's wife, Mi Kas, waiting to board a Cessna Citation X that would take them to Hawaii. There, Bolin suspected the trio would have to endure yet another debriefing, as well as a tongue-lashing for having violated the terms of their defection. But eventually, they would be back on the mainland and in a position to get their lives back in order. No matter how rough it might be for them to yet again readjust to new identities, Bolin hoped they would realize how much better off they were than if the REDI agents had managed to haul them back into their homeland. When Shin Kam-song spotted Bolin and Cook, he motioned to his wife and Lee Ru Kobe, and soon the three of them were shuttling across the tarmac toward their liberators.
We were hoping to see you. We owe you our lives.
Just doing our jobs.
How can we thank you?
Play it safer this time. Remember, this isn't North Korea. Here the people checking up on you are doing it for your own good. Understood?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
We wish you all luck. Goodbye.
Same to both of you.
The executioner veered toward another plane that had landed on the runway earlier. It was a C-130 Hercules on a supply run from Oahu. Along with the usual shipment of equipment and food rations, the plane's cargo included nearly 24 wooden caskets intended for the victims of the firefight that had taken place earlier on the other side of the island. Jane Bond stood near the rear of the plane, her right arm in a sling, watching the caskets being placed on a tram for the short trip to the nearby hangar where the bodies had been transferred. She didn't notice Bolin until he'd reached her side.
If that bullet had hit me another inch to the right, one of those caskets would be for me.
Perspective. An hour ago, you were complaining because you couldn't finish out the mission.
Yeah, well, that still sucks, but at least when I fly back, I'll be riding first class instead of lying horizontal.
Not a bad consolation prize. And if that gangbanger back in L.A. fingers Hong as the guy who killed Star, you'll have done what you set out to do.
Yeah, maybe so. Hell, I might even get some of that bonus I was talking about.
Don't spend it all in one place.
So, when do you head out?
Soon.
Good luck to you.
Thanks. I have a feeling I'll be needing it.
You'll be fine. I'll be up and running in no time myself. How long do you figure it'll be before we crash into each other again?
I'll let the fates take care of that.
Bond stared into Bolin's eyes, then leaned forward and kissed him on the cheek.
You never talk about your love life, but I assume there's someone out there burning the home fires.
Something like that.
Go knock him dead, soldier.
Will do.
Bolin turned and watched Bond stride across the tarmac. He knew the odds were he'd never see her again. But then he'd thought the same thing twice before.
Who knows? Time will tell.
As the guards dragged Sai through the twilight from Yim's bungalow to the prison yard, he had little trouble playing the part of a disgruntled malcontent. His skull still throbbed from where Major Jin had struck him with the whiskey bottle, and he had to breathe through his mouth because his sinuses were clogged from the swelling of his broken nose. And instead of one black eye, Sai had two. Sai's mood matched his sorry appearance. Once he'd come to the floor of Yim's den, Jin and the Commandant had dragged him to the phone and presented him with a scripted preliminary report informing MII that suspicion of complicity in Operation Guillotine had shifted to several of Jin's subordinates, including the private who'd been dispatched to kill General O. Sai had had a gun to his head when he'd called in the report, with Jin vowing to pull the trigger if Sai strayed from the script and tried to slip in anything that sounded like a possible code phrase that would inform MII that he was making the report under duress. He'd been told to blame a head cold instead of a broken nose for the obvious change in his voice. Having no other real option, Sai had played along, but the fear he'd initially felt after having his cover blown had now been replaced by a simmering rage. It was bad enough that he'd been forced to play double agent to save himself. The smug condescension with which Jin and Yim had treated him had fueled his contempt for his tormentors. Yes, he would do their bidding as long as necessary, but if it was the last thing he ever did, Sai was determined to see the day when he could turn the tables on the two conspirators.
In the barracks!
God damn you all! You get yours, you mindless drones!
Sai was struggling to his feet when one of the men reached out and lent him a hand.
You seem to have fallen out of favor.
Sai immediately recognized the deposed captain from the description Yim had given him. However, he gave no indication that he knew the man. Instead, Sai glared past him at the bungalow doorway.
God damn you all! You cowards! Pinheads! Bastards!
My name's Kwak Il-su.
Sai.
What did you do to prompt such a beating?
You tell me.
Concealed beneath one of the buttons of Sai's uniform was a bugging device he'd intended to use on Yim.
I came here today on a routine field tour for the Ministry of Agriculture. I was supposed to make an evaluation of how to better improve the poppy cultivation. But after checking the soil, I said the land could be put to better use growing potatoes or some other produce. I was just making a statement, but apparently they thought I was questioning the regime's priorities. Because the next thing I knew, I was being used as a human punching bag. Because of a simple misunderstanding on their part, I'm not only disgraced, but my life as I know it is over. Where's the justice in that?
Trust me, I have walked in similar shoes myself, and I'm here for a reason much like yours.
I find that hard to believe.
It's true. While inspecting the latest renovations to the mausoleum where the remains of Kim Il-sung have been interred, I casually speculated on how much food and medicine could have been purchased with the hundreds of millions of dollars that had been poured into the monument. 2 days later, I was dragged out of bed, shackled, beaten, and brought here. These thugs have misconstrued my statement as treacherous. There's no way to convince them otherwise.
One has to wonder if someone is in the right. They're normally not so quick to read false meanings into everything said about them.
It's paranoia. And usually it's a sign that someone secretly knows they're in the wrong, but can't face up to it.
Perhaps. But a lot of good it does us know we've been wronged. Give me a choice, and I think I would prefer to be a little less righteous and a little more free.
Patience. As it turns out, your plight might not be as dire as you think.
I know how these camps work. You come here on a one-way ticket. There's no way out.
Maybe. Maybe not. We'll see.
In that instant, Sai figured he was in. With any luck, he could continue to play Kwak like a fish on a hook, feeding out line and then reeling him in until he had all the information Yim was looking for regarding the intended prison revolt. And if the ringleader were to become reticent, Sai had another two bugging devices with him. All he would have to do is plant them near where Kwak and his co-conspirators would gather to make their last-minute arrangements. Either way, he would have done what Yim had asked, and hopefully Tsai would have bought the time necessary to untangle himself from the web he'd found himself caught in. After leaving Lieutenant Corporal Yim's bungalow, Jin went straight to his office and waited for his subordinate to return from his mission.
Come in. I want to hear good news, Private.
The mission was a success, sir.
Good.
However, there is one small issue about a phone that was on during the executions. I brought it back with me. I hope I did the right thing bringing it back.
You really didn't have much choice. Ah, good. He wasn't on the phone with MII officials. He was, however, on the phone with his nephew, Park Yo-wee. This will be easy to fix.
Is there anything else you'd like me to do, then?
Yes, and I'm entrusting this to you only because you've proved yourself reliable. Not to mention worthy of promotion if you succeed.
Thank you, sir. I've never been one to back down from a challenge.
Good. And you were right about our needing to take care of the person General O was talking to. You're the man to see to it. All you have to do is get back on that motorcycle and take a quick ride to Kijongdong.
The sun was setting on Propaganda Village. The tall, empty buildings cast long shadows on dusty streets that were every bit as empty, except for the construction vehicles surrounding the large mall where Park Yo-wee was overseeing the installation of North Korea's top-secret missile launch facility. Park stood outside the monolithic facade.
He's dead.
And if his uncle had been murdered, Park couldn't help feeling that he was responsible. What other explanation could there be but that Oh had acted on his nephew's suspicions about Major Jin and paid the price?
We're running low on rivets. Are we expecting another shipment soon?
The day after tomorrow.
Is there any way we can get them sooner?
I'll see what I can do. But for now, go ahead and finish up for the night.
As the worker headed back to the supply area, Park stared down at his cell phone and began to tremble again. Although he was in charge of construction, all non-budgeted financial transactions needed to be routed through Major Jin. He couldn't make the call to the man he suspected was responsible for his uncle's death. Park turned his back to the mall and strode the other way, lengthening his stride until he was almost running to put as much distance as possible between himself and another interruption. He'd circled halfway around the looming edifice before he slowed his pace. By then, the sun was down and a thick cloud cover had blacked out the moon, leaving the empty city looking even more desolate. A few yards later, he came upon the rear entrance. A guard stood nearby, leaning against the side of a parked Jeep, more preoccupied with cleaning his fingernails than standing watch. At the sight of Park, the man pushed away from the vehicle and grabbed for his carbine. Park waved the man off. Park strode past the unfinished launch tower and made his way quickly to the mobile home serving as his office and living quarters. From the drawer beneath the table, Park took out a small dog-eared address book. He stopped at Jeong Bong-chul's number, a colleague he hadn't spoken to since his work on one of Kim Jong-il's country retreats more than 14 months ago. Park wasn't even sure if the man still worked for the Ministry of Internal Intelligence, but he didn't know where else to turn.
Hello, Jung. This is Park Yo-wee. Do you still work for the MII?
I do. Is something the matter, Park?
Yes. It's my uncle, Ochol. I think he's been murdered, leaving camp because he inspected a couple of officers after I relayed a suspicion that's been going around these parts.
Slow down, Yo-wee. Did I hear you correctly? Ochol is your uncle?
Yes, and I think he's been murdered by some of the people I work for.
All right. Tell me exactly what happened.
There have been rumors that Major Jin Chonye has been diverting goods to the black market when my uncle visited. I told him about it. I believe he then asked Jin about his involvement. Then later I was on the phone with my uncle as he was driving out of camp and a motorcycle or something approached him. He told me to hang on a second. I heard a lot of gunshots and then someone hung up the phone. They killed him.
Listen to me very carefully. It's good you called me. MII is already investigating Major Jin, as well as other officials at the Changchun facilities. In fact, just today, an undercover agent had been sent to Changchun to gather more information. We've received a preliminary report from him that has raised more questions than it answers. There's something very wrong going on there. And from the sounds of it, your uncle got caught up in the middle of it.
I knew it! I should have never told him.
Wait, I haven't finished, Yui. You need to understand something. From what you've told me, I have reason to believe that you could be in danger. I'll do what I can to help get to the bottom of all this, but it will take time, I'm afraid. Until then, you need to watch your back. Is that clear?
What am I supposed to do?
Are you in a safe place?
I'm in my office inside the launch facility. I don't know where else I could go.
Do you have a gun with you?
No.
Just stay put then. Turn your lights off and pretend you're asleep. I'll do what I can.
Back at the Stony Man Farms computer lab, Brignola and Price stared over Kurtzman's shoulder as he was pulling in feeds from the NSA SATCAMs that had been redeployed over the Changchun mountain range.
Well, it's a good news, bad news thing, guys. These clouds that have rolled in will help with the insertions, but they're putting a crimp on the eyes in the sky.
Yeah, can't really see much.
At least I should have some infrared readings in a while. Hopefully that'll give us some idea of how the place checks out in terms of nukes.
Are you sure? If they're just storing the missiles there, their payloads will be sealed up enough to avoid detection, right?
Good point. If we're lucky, though, they might have some sort of testing facility that would give off a reading.
I wouldn't count on it. Outside of Mac finally neutralizing that ready crew, our luck on this front has been running a bit on the cold side.
Still, keep working on it. Maybe our luck will start turning.
Brignola and Price left Kurtzman and moved on to Akira Takedo's station, where Kissinger was still hard at work, helping the cyber crew monitor the North Korean crisis.
Here's a scoop. Along with special ops teams across the DMZ, the Navy just rerouted two carriers, and the Air Force is readying a mini-squadron of F-111F fighter jets for use if matters escalate to where we need to attack the mountain base with GBU-28 bunker busters. Of course, if it comes to that, we're talking all-out war, so you gotta figure that's a last resort.
I've already talked with the President. If need be, he's ready to call an emergency session at Congress so we can get a green light to take action.
That could take a while, don't you think? What if the KPA sees what we're up to and kicks things into high gear before we can cut through the red tape?
I think you know the answer to that. We'll do what we have to and worry about protocol afterward.
Hey, guys. On the bright side, we might not have to do it alone.
Carmen, you managed to get through to Hildecker?
Indirectly. I've been online with this Corporal Michaels guy Akira was working with. He's been keeping tabs with Hildecker, and she says she's working the Allies for some assistance. Japan and South Korea are already on board, and word is that China's been more than receptive ever since hearing about this possible coup. They might throw in if we sweeten the pot enough.
That's not likely to happen. We're just looking to defuse things, not take the place over and start divvying out slices.
Well, I don't know if they'll be thinking in terms of a land grab. I think they're just tired of refugees spilling over the border. If things calm down enough that people quit fleeing the country, that might be good enough for them. That and some kind of softening on our trade stance with them.
Hey, whatever works, Price. Hell, if it means yanking nukes out of their backyard, even Russia'll probably kick in before this is all over.
Who'd have thought we'd ever be having a conversation where both Russia and China come off sounding like allies?
War's the same as politics, Hal. Makes for strange bedfellows sometimes.
Brignola's gaze strayed from the computer area to the far wall monitors. One of the screens was filled with a map focused solely on the Korean Peninsula around the 38th parallel. Barring any flight disruptions, the cargo plane carrying Mac Bolan and the Army Ranger crew from Zane Island would soon be landing at Camp Boniface to pick up Akira Takedo and the ops force Colonel Michaels had put together. The fate of their hastily plotted mission across the DMZ would likely determine whether the world would be able to step back from the brink of a showdown with nuclear consequences.
The ball's in your court, Stryker. We're counting on you.
Mac Bolan stood in the open doorway as Corporal Thomas Michaels' hand-picked crew of Army Rangers scrambled up the mobile staircase into the passenger cabin of the young 333 cargo plane that had just landed moments before on the runway at Camp Boniface.
Keep moving, and don't be picky about where you sit. We're on a tight schedule.
Bolan wasn't exaggerating. The Army had earlier dispatched a decoy plane from Osan Air Base to assume the young's flight path while it diverted to Boniface. And for the sleight of hand to succeed, the 333 needed to take off as quickly as possible so that it could reclaim its airspace before crossing into range of the KPA's military radar. After that, of course, there remained the even more difficult challenge of straying off course a second time to allow for the insertion of the special ops team miles inland from their charted destination of Kaesong. Bullen had checked in with the farm while in the air, and it sounded as if they might be able to use the cloud cover as an excuse for the second diversion. It would be a moot point, however, if the KPA was given reason to believe that something was amiss with the flight supposedly carrying the captured members of the Kangye nuclear team. The Rangers boarded the plane and settled in alongside their counterparts from Zane Island. Colonel Michaels had already begged off the mission, feeling he'd be more useful working with intel angles and keeping Undersecretary of State Hildecker supplied with any necessary updates. The female diplomat, along with the rest of the U.S. negotiating team, had been withdrawn from Panmunjom a few hours earlier and were cloistered in bunker quarters located beneath the base's CRCC compound. In light of the heightening crisis, it had been decided that it would be wiser for them to carry on their negotiations from a safe distance rather than within firing range of North Korea's DMZ security detail.
Welcome aboard, Ranger.
Hey, no flack, Mac. It's not like this is the first time I've stepped out of the office.
I hear you, Takedo. And I'm sure it won't be the last.
How about those bullet holes? Souvenirs from the rescue effort?
Better the plane's hide than mine. All right, Captain, all aboard. Let's get this show on the road.